various problems are simultaneously resolved. First, the already mentioned problem of originality, which the painter Degas dispatches with lapidary precision. He says, there are children who have not been baptized, but there has never been a child who had no mother. And second, the problem of the presence of the past, a kind of verbal necessity to heed the language that came before us, which T.S. Eliot resumes as the obligation that the past, I quote, the past be altered by the present as much as the present is altered by the past. Such, after all, is the common task of every writer as he confronts time and its true relationship with history. The historical sense, as Eliot, is a sense of the timeless as well as the temporal, and of the timeless and of the temporal together. In her last and unfinished novel, Between the Acts, Virginia Woolf speaks of a room as a seashell, singing of what was before time was. This absolute, this platonic idea, nevertheless, must finally coexist with the sense of history, but that sense is truly historical only, and in this the novelist Woolf and the poet Eliot concur, as all forms of literature concur in their final shared poetical reality, only, I quote, if it involves a perception, not only of the pastness of the past, but of its presence. The historical sense of history compels a man, writes Virginia Woolf, a woman, to write not merely with his own generation in his bones, but with a feeling that the whole of the literature of Europe since Homer, and within it, the whole of the literature of his own country, has a simultaneous existence and comprises a simultaneous order. The historical sense, Virginia Woolf goes on, is what makes a writer traditional. It is at the same time what makes a writer most acutely conscious of his place in time, of his own contemporaneity. The historicity of the novel is what Virginia Woolf is referring to, not the ordinary servitude the French call la petite histoire, the odd event, the anecdote. There has always been someone who told stories. Narration was not invented by Cervantes, the Marquis de Lafayette, or Lawrence Stern. Quite simply, modern novelists inverted the criterion of truth in order to be able to judge the narrated event. The 1001 Nights is true because it never disguises its fantasy. Don Quixote or Tristram Shandy seem to anchor the novel in a social and psychological reality, but only that they may liberate it from the pretense of truth. Reality is merely an appearance that allows the novelist to disguise the making of his novel as a remaking of other fictions. The modern novel thus belongs more to the history of the novel than to the novel of history. If Don Quixote is the protagonist of one supreme and heroic feat, it is that of restoring the utopic past of Amadis and his brethren in chivalry within the corrupt present of the Spanish Habsburgs, and thus of establishing the criterion of an internal historicity, internal to the novel, that is lacking in the European novels that are nothing more than novels written in the 17th century. I am not talking, of course, of anachronism. There's a very silly and funny Spanish play of the 19th century in which a man dresses in armor and suddenly takes out his sword, says goodbye to his wife and children, and says, goodbye, goodbye, I will see you soon as I return from the 30 years war to which I am going now. Or the extreme to which this sort of historical anachronism is also taken by a Mexican writer, Fernando Benitez, who wrote a play on Christopher Columbus, in which we, the audience, are set with the Indians at Guanani, while the caravels of Columbus come towards us, towards the stage, from the end of the stage, the front of the stage, and the Indians are watching the arrival, and they see these ships and start jumping all over the stage and saying, hooray, hooray, we have been discovered. This is not the historical criterion to which I'm referring tonight. Statistically, for example, we know through Philippe Erlanger that in the 17th century, One French novel was published every week, 350 during the reign of Louis XIV. But only one of them, Malraux points out, is entitled La Princesse de Clèves. And it is the creation at once autonomous and traditional of Laurence Sterne, which in turn gives reality to the books that did not survive their century, except to the degree that they nourished the tradition of Tristram Shandy. Other than the Sterne specialist, who remembers John Dunton and his eulogy of parenthetical narration in his Voyage Around the World of 1691, or the memoirs of the extraordinary life, works, and discoveries of Martinus Scriblerus of 1714, and its punitive allegory of learning, or the unbridled attack of Professor Mencken the First, Orationes Due de Charlataneria Eruditorum, Emeritus of the University of Leipzig, in his work of 1715, against the logicians, the doctors who examine garbage, the philosophers, the extravagant empiricists, the academic apes, and the grammatical and critical nation, a ferocious people. In relation to historical time, the purest of novelists is a vacuum cleaner, and the purest of novels a garbage can. The wedding of the novel with immediate history is a novelty that soon, in the course of the honeymoon itself, in fact, reveals its adulterous deceit. The novel, the vehicle of critical ambiguity in the modern age, offers lodging to the true historical event, only to divest it of its veracity in the world of things and transform it into a subject of the world of words. The fact that Madame Bovary is founded on the suicide of a certain Madame de la Mare only serves to bury that scandal in the most obscure oblivion and enables fiction to triumph in the match between itself and some chance event of reality. Emma Bovary owes more to Don Quixote, that other reader of romances, than to a provincial woman who committed suicide, in the same way that Julien Sorel, no matter how virginal he may appear in his dazzling literary apparition, is less the twin of the obscure seminarian and murderer Berthet, on whose personality Stendhal founded the character of Sorel, than the flesh and blood echo at the apogee of a century's mystery and sensibility of Napoleon Bonaparte. And for that reason, Julien Sorel is the brother to the true Napoleonic murderer, Raskolnikov, who in the shadows of Tsarist Russia denuded the emperor's epic of glory and inflicted upon him a defeat worse than the retreat of 1812. Gratuitous power leads only to the killing of an old crone. Through the medium of this internal historicity we're talking about, Dostoevsky restores tragedy to the novel. He makes a past become present and projects a future without illusions, in regard to guaranteed happiness, the happiness that the Enlightenment, the 18th century, wished to guarantee for all mankind. A still more profound historicity colors the destiny of Stendhal. A writer frustrated and misunderstood in his time, Henri Bayle believed that every great writer creates the sensibility by which he will be judged in the future. When one speaks of the revolution of the novel in the 20th century, I think the two names of Musil and Joyce and Proust and Kafka and Mann, one must necessarily add the name of that great resurrected Stendhal. His works encounter its present in our own in such a way that his past has become our future. This Lazarus of the novel, Stendhal, illuminates the relationships between literature and history. Let us argue that Waterloo could have existed without Fabrizio Veldongo, while the protagonist of the Charterhouse of Parma could not have existed without Waterloo. But this criterion presupposes that history would then constitute a new kind of absolute, and that literature is a chapter subordinate to history. Plato relegated literature and history to the same level of subordination. May things be known without their names, either Waterloo or Fabrizio? Socrates replies, yes. There is no way but this, the most natural and direct, to know things through themselves and through the relationships they establish among themselves, if they are compatible. But no, not ever, no, never, through deceitful, capricious, and unreal words. Pity the man who puts his trust in the truth of words, exclaims Socrates, and thus delivers his being and his soul to the control of names. A disciple of the false Heraclitus, he will have become a man suffering a metaphysical cold, constantly dripping and running, like dripping and running time, and his life will be like a house with a leaking roof or a cooking pot that does not know it is a sieve. Time and language are condemned to brotherhood, but also to falsehood. Werner Jaeger explains that the supreme conjunction of the poetic and historic values of Athens tragedy was never seen by the men of the age of Pericles to be a purely aesthetic event. So great was its power that the Athenians made the tragic poet responsible for the condition, for the spirit of the entire state. According to the author of the Paideia, the tragic poet possessed a greater and more grave political responsibility than that of the politicians who governed the city. This explains Plato's attack on poetic freedom, explains Jaeger. As he attacks the poet, Plato is attacking power, for Sophocles was more powerful than Alcibiades. If this was true in the 5th century before Christ, it has never again been true in terms of realpolitik. The works of Victor Hugo have survived longer than those of Napoleon III, and the works of Pablo Neruda will outlast those of Pinochet. But no one has taken up arms in order to unseat Hugo or Neruda for the abuse of temporal power. The latter, on the other hand, has seen to it that literature achieve its sole political power by persecuting it from Socrates to Mandelstam, from Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz to Dashiell Hammett, in the figure of that eternal victim of all inquisitions, the scribbler K. How was literature, the sister of time in antiquity, converted into its victim, and time, the accomplice of the deceits of literature, into the canon of truth, against which, under the name of history, all the activities of naming, including poetry, were to be measured? I think that while it shared with history the circle of deception, literature, conceived as myth, epic, and tragedy, also experienced with it an awareness of defeat. Poetry and history were no more than, but this no more was everything, the stage set for a fleeting passage subject to triumphs and defeats, affirmations and negations, happiness and sorrow, entrances and exits. Myth, epic, and tragic literature illuminated the changeable strangeness of history, but history did not dominate literature, with which it participated in the flowing illusion of Heraclitus' river, two floating bodies embraced, moving against the current, heroes and eros, the hero of history and the love of poetry, traveling together from the ocean to the origin of the origin, towards the mountain, the seat of tragic destiny, the homeland of the goat and the name of Orestes, the name of hero and of eros, who keeps the city, violates it, and restores it. Nothing more symbolic than the destiny of this name, Orestes, which means come from the mountain, and its parallel action in time and literature, affecting history in order to save it through poetry, and punishing poetry in the fulfillment of its inevitable obligation to history. While history is personified in tragic poetry, it is limited by it, and only in it does it find a living, talking correspondent. History cannot be converted into the absolute. Its partial destiny is none other than the destiny of the word itself. Tragedy does not inhabit empty space, yet tragedy may be possible in a world without space. But in a world without time, three things are impossible: ancient tragedy, with its egalitarian association with time, modern utopia, which delivers its weapons to a time that will betray it, and the novel, which represents the compensation of the word for the insufficiencies of a time that has violated its own utopian promise. Max Scheler says that tragedy occurs within the world of values, not within the world of virtues, and that conflict among values presupposes duration because tragedy is not fatal. That is, tragedy may be oracular in its destiny, but it is not immediate in its effect. It requires time, and by requiring time, it becomes necessary. Tragedy, says Scheller, creates an order which, like causality, is inscribed in time, but tragic necessity is neither fatal nor causal. It neither obeys the law of cause and effect, which is sovereignly indifferent to the values of things, nor does it obey a determinism inscribed in a verbal or genetic nature. There would be no tragedy in a world in which the systematic legality of cause and effect accorded to each thing the powers and capacities corresponding to its values. But as such a world does not exist, nor ever has existed, we must conclude that tragedy does exist and has always existed, and that when we are not aware of it, two terrible things are happening. First, we are deceiving ourselves in respect to the goodness of the world we inhabit. We are looking at the world through the rose-colored glasses of Dr. Pangloss. And second, tragedy is preparing to launch an attack against us, like the beast in the jungle, taking advantage of our complacency. This is what has happened in the 20th century. Its consequences have been bloody, and they continue to be bloody. But there would be no tragedy if we did not understand that it is freedom that resists catastrophe, and that only because of freedom is tragedy saved from its natural fatality, as well as from the rationalist will that veils the permanence of the tragic beneath a gold-colored cloth, and thus, as Nietzsche predicted, prepares us to become the victims of a world in which, since all things have a meaning, one exception is sufficient to assure that all things cease to have a meaning. Freedom, in fact, may be the value itself vanquished in tragic struggle, yet the only value capable of tragically conquering freedom is freedom itself. Prometheus loses his freedom by using his freedom. Nothing is fatal in the destinies of Oedipus, Medea, or Antigone. Neither is anything causal. The knot of tragedy, what Max Scheler calls the knot of tragedy, is in this conflict between equally vigorous values. The well-being of the individual opposed to the well-being of the city, Antigone. The genetic value of the mother opposed to the erotic value of the wife, Medea. The value of free will opposed to the value of divine will, Prometheus. One does not destroy the other, but in order to resolve itself into its opposite, it transforms it and transforms itself, and in the process of enduring, identifies itself with the time the tragedy requires to transmute value into disaster and catastrophe into knowledge. In this duration, tragedy not only identifies with time, more importantly, it identifies time. It is interesting, I think, to emphasize two consequences of the preceding. The first is the position of language in the tragic conflict. Whether we call it destiny, as I prefer to, or fatality, which is the choice of the French critic Jean-Marie Domenach, the tragic act is a word spoken about oneself, a blessing, a curse, a warning, a simple naming. The tragic word, says Domenach, the word that surrounds the tragic character, precedes him, presages him, and forces him to justify the word. Only he can give to that word the meaning it demands. The Latin fatum, it was said, the Arabic mahtub, it was written. Destiny is prefigured in words directed to freedom. I told you so. You were warned. The War of Troy takes place when words are spoken. The hero's passion requires the word that will personalize and socialize his passion. These mother words, honor, justice, dignity, courage, permit the tragic actor to surrender himself to his passion. The chorus warns him, the actor chooses freely the loss of his freedom. The second consequence is that tragedy does not admit guilt. In tragedy, everyone is right and no one is right. The tyrant Creon is right in speaking in the name of the collective rights, but so is Antigone, who speaks in the name of individual rights. Let us recall the formula proposed by Albert Camus in L'Homme Révolté, The Rebel. The forces that confront one another in tragedy are equally legitimate, says the French writer. In drama or in melodrama, only one may be legitimate, only one. The melodramatic formula may be only one is just and justifiable, and the tragic formula, all are justifiable, no one is just. Literature can be the key either to harmony or to rebellion. Oedipus and Antigone are in harmony with the polis. Adam and Eve are not in harmony with paradise. And the Old Testament deceptively situates the fall in their drama. Centuries of moral precepts and prestigious iconography would have us believe that our first father and mother fell from grace and that, therefore, they are the authors of our expulsion. I believe rather that if Adam and Eve fall from the icy grave of Yahweh, they ascend to the warm grace of Eros. The temptation of Eve is not fragility, it is desire. And it leads to the union and plenitude of love, not to the sin and misfortune that has been assigned to Adam and Eve. They are responsible for a different sin, which is not the sin of the flesh. Rather, their sin is the sin of humanizing God, of causing him to enter the eternal circuit of perpetuating love in spite of the difference between the creator and the created, and that difference is desire. Eve does not transgress, Cain does, and if there is to be justice, then it is his story that must be told. The act of Adam and Eve was presented as sin in order to justify authority over any being who is disgraced. In truth, the fall is the fall of Cain, who is the first murderer. We may say that human history begins with the first love, that of Adam and Eve. But perhaps literature, the terrible chronicle of the time of expulsion and alienation, begins with the death of the first man, Abel, and it is the story of the first man on earth to die. It was enough that a man die, that the story of his death should be told. No one writes about the immortals because they have no need to be remembered. The literature of alienation belongs to the Hebraic tradition. It is called morality, and morality always contains an underlying element of rebellion as well as justice. The literature of reunion belongs to the Greek tradition. It is called tragedy, and it excludes morality and guilt. The fragility of temporal changing Greece allows a tragic destiny to appear as a handhold to prevent history's drowning in history. But since poetry is as relative as history, partly truth and partly falsehood, as we have stated, time does not impose itself upon poetry, nor does poetry tyrannize time. The Greeks do not lie. The absolute is the absolute. It is somewhere else, and it has the decency to make itself invisible. Human space is occupied by history and poetry in a sort of egalitarian tension. Both recall that, like time, man is fragile, but like his poetry, enduring. Christian optimism, with its promise of a better life after, in the beyond, vociferously invites its own destruction by the secular optimism that places the promise of the next world here on earth. Christian history, an uneasy accord between divine will and the human agent who enacts it, inevitably appears to the human to be a contradiction between his ends and those of the deity in the words of Collingwood in The Idea of History. Giambattista Vico, in the Scienza Nova of 1534, equates the history of man with the work of man, but he refuses to deprive man of the awareness of imagination. As he invents the history of civilizations, the great Neapolitan writer affirms that, I quote, "the rule and criterion of knowing anything truly is to have made it oneself. But such a privilege, that of being the author of history, is given to men only under the condition that they be capable of imagining the past by keeping it alive in the present, and thus of limiting humanist pride in a perfect and certain future. Progress, since it does not explain art, is not necessarily valuable. History, which is the work of man, is not a new absolute, but rather the relationship among his partial but irreducible values." Vico speaks of stones, caves, monuments, tongues, institutions, customs, laws. History is reality in the act of being lived, and its cognizable value is not reason. Clarity, says Vico, is the vice of human reason more than its virtue, since a clear idea is an idea that has been completed. Not reason then, but imagination, which allows us to know that the explanation of all things comes from the very depths of time, of all times. A hero of thought, an original genius, Paul Hazard calls Vico, who in our century was to become the philosopher in residence of to James Joyce, who called his Finnegan's Wake a Vico cyclometer. The 18th century detested Vico, silenced him, and denied him the discovery that Isaiah Berlin credits to him in his splendid study, Vico and Herder, that of having invented the sense of historical perspective. Naturally, if history is the work of humans, only human imagination can reconstruct it and preserve it. Revelation, a unique and absolute act, cannot be supplanted by a humanist fallacy that substitutes a fixed and invariable human nature for a divine will with the same characteristics. This is what the triumphant strain of the Enlightenment accomplished. It deprived human history of the dialectical malleability that Vico wanted to give it. It cut off the perspective, imagination, and cultural reconstitution. More than anything, it deprived it of the sense of tragedy. Happiness, felicidad, bonheur, felicita, the absolute rooted in human nature, devoid of the past, begun in the present instant, that breaks the chains of previous barbarity and promises happiness on earth. For everyone? Well, no. First for white men, then property owners, then perhaps, maybe, when? Well, tomorrow, probably, as soon as we finish this tremendous trial against God, tragic pessimism, and historical barbarity. Tomorrow denies us its face, but only tomorrow will happiness exist. The Protestant Reform said this is the true God. The Enlightenment said there is no true God. Voltaire, unlike Luther, did not attempt to take possession of religion, but rather to make it disappear entirely, écraser l'infâme. The death of God makes man fully responsible for his own history. It does not make him either happy or free, because in place of accepting the tragic alternatives in his search for happiness, the 18th century man, in the name of human reason, constructs a secular absolutism as oppressive, as hermetic, and as diminishing as divine absolutism had been in the past. The most lucid man of the French Revolution, the young, the glorious, terrible, and unfortunate Saint-Just, confronted head-on what he referred to as the struggle between the demon of hope and the demon of fatality, cross and crossroads of the revolutions, in which first, according to Saint-Just, words at last become acts, and this is the glory and the hope of history, and then the force of things, la force des choses, leads us to results we had not foreseen, and this is the confusion and contradiction of history. The revolution against the enemies of the revolution is epic. The revolution against the revolution is tragic. In Danton's death by another tragic youth, Georg Büchner, his protagonist, Danton, says, I quote, "Never again will it be possible to accuse God, because God does not exist. Rebellious freedom has occupied all the space of the world." These warnings were not heard by history, and the tragedy of history became the absence of tragedy. denied, exorcised, and masked, evil, as Hannah Arendt suggested, reappeared in all its banality. Auschwitz, Hiroshima, the Gulag, My Lai, the prisons and tortures of Chile, Uruguay, and Argentina are not tragedies, they are crimes. They are a corruption of the tragic. For in tragedy, the conflict must lie between equal values, whereas in modern history, an inferior evil can destroy the superior value of life, and when an object of superior value is destroyed by an object as evil as Nazism or as insignificant as a South American dictator, tragedy becomes impossible and irrational. For that reason, our century has not been capable of provoking tragic compassion, only painful indignation.